Very well. The next case on calendar is Mark Moore versus State of Nevada Department of Corrections. It is case number 62398. We have counsel for the appellant in Las Vegas and counsel for the respondent in Carson City. This is the first time we have ever done this with counsel appearing by video, but inasmuch as I'm here, we decided to give it a try. So you need to bear with us. The video equipment sometimes has a delay in between the time a person speaks and the relay. So you have to give a pause before you answer a question from the court, or it'll seem that you're talking over one another. So with that caution, is counsel for the appellant ready to proceed? Very well, you may approach.
Thank you, Your Honor. Nathan Henderson on behalf of Appellant Mark Moore, and I want to start by thank you for engaging in this experiment on my behalf. I very much appreciate it. This appeal poses the question of whether equitable tolling is appropriate where the statute of limitations passes during the pendency of a case filed by a pro se litigant and dismissed without prejudice on technical grounds. At its core, this appeal is about equal access to the law. While it is certainly true that a pro se litigant must follow the rules of civil procedure, if pro se litigants are penalized both by dismissal of their case and by the running of the statute of limitations during the pendency of their cases, then the ability of unlearned individuals to represent themselves will be significantly impaired. Now, the facts of this case are rather important. Mr. Moore is, and at all relevant times, was a prisoner held by the Nevada Department of Corrections. This case arises from the state's wrongful failure to provide Mr. Moore with a parole hearing for 10 months, beginning on February 9, 2008. Now, February 9, 2008 is the first date that can possibly, it's the earliest date that can possibly be given for the beginning of the statute of limitations to run, because prior to that, Mr. Moore had no injury. He may have had a suspicion of that an injury may be coming, and in fact, he had then sent mixed messages of whether or not it would come. But if he had filed any kind of case at that point, it would not have been ripe for consideration. So the very earliest date is February 9, 2008. Mr. Moore has argued December 8, 2008, but for simplicity, from this point on, I'd ask that we assume February 9, 2008 is the date that the statute of limitations began to toll, because under either case, his second civil suit should not have been dismissed. So, Mr. Moore, during the time that he was still waiting to receive his parole hearing, on September 24, 2008, Mr. Moore filed an administrative grievance, which ran for 50 days and was dismissed on November 13, 2008. As the state has conceded, those 50 days are automatically tolled as far as the running of statute of limitations is concerned, which makes a difference if we assume February 9th, 2008 to be the beginning. It doesn't, actually, if we take December 8th. 13 days after his administrative grievance failed, Mr. Moore promptly filed a habeas petition on November 26, 2008. Now, shortly after that habeas petition was filed, he was given his hearing, and a habeas corpus no longer became the proper way for him to seek recovery. And so that case was dismissed on moot on that grounds alone, which he then appealed and was unsuccessful with a final determination being reached on October 21st, 2009. A mere 3 months later, Mr. Moore filed his first suit on January 25th, 2010 to recover damages. Now, Mr. Moore is a pro se litigant with no experience in the law or understanding of the rules of civil procedure. He made several misguided, incorrect attempts to move his case along, which included filing a request for case status, sending a letter to the clerk of the court, and serving a request for documents on the state before his case was dismissed. And then once his case was dismissed, filing a request for a Rule 16.1 conference. But he filed that too late. And that's correct. The court ruled correctly that because he had not sought a Rule 16.1 conference, his case should have been dismissed on procedural grounds without prejudice. And that's what happened. 21 days later, on July 30th, 2012, Mr. Moore filed a new case. Now, if we assume February 9th as the starting running of the statute of limitations, and 50 days tolling for the administrative grievance. And then if we also assume that that first case told the statute of limitations, then it would have run on August 28, 2012, 29 days after the second civil war.
But you have to toll for the first case in order to get by the statute of limitations, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. My point in pointing that out in the beginning is that there's a reason for me to be talking about this.
Yes.
So, and then 14 days after that dismissal, Mr. Moore filed this appeal. So this question is new for the state of Nevada, but it has already been addressed by the Federal District Court for Nevada in Weisenbaker v. Farewell. And Mr. Moore would urge the court to follow that ruling. In Weisenbaker, the court looked to two factors from the case of Copeland v. Desert Inn Hotel, which considered the tolling of the statute of limitations. Those two factors, which are also applicable in this case, are the diligence of the plaintiff and the potential prejudice to the defendant. With regards to diligence, to reiterate a few points from the introduction that I think are worth bearing in mind, Moore began seeking his claim during the time of the delay. He then went on to file an administrative grievance, three separate court cases, and two judicial appeals seeking relief for his claim. The longest period.
What about the fact that he didn't request the case conference during the first case? That would normally be a lack of diligence on the part of a litigant. And we're kind of betwixt and between here, because we have the rules of civil procedure. The dismissal, if he had had counsel in the first case, would have been justified under our rules of civil procedure.
Absolutely.
He is incarcerated, which is more burdensome even than just being pro se. But I struggle with whether philosophically we should suspend the rules of civil procedure for someone who engages the court process.
Well,
and I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I would say that the, first of all, I think it's worth bearing in mind that normally in Nevada, because we do, the preference is to have cases heard on their merits. When a case is dismissed on procedural grounds, the litigant is able to refile. And I think that is the same thing that happens here. And especially when we're considering the fact that this standard looks to diligence, not knowledge or familiarity with the law. The fact that he did make those three attempts to communicate with the court to get things rolling, and the fact that once he filed his second claim, he right out the gate sent out a Rule 16.1 conference request, I think speaks to the fact that he certainly was a diligent litigant. And, you know, if I could write the law for the court, I think that the proper ruling would be the rules of civil procedure apply, your case will be dismissed. But that will not be the end. Well, you know, if you refile, follow the rules, learn the rules, you'll be able to pursue your claim.
Fair enough. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So there's that issue, that point as to diligence. And then the next thing is that the longest Moore ever waited between a final determination and filing his next attempt to seek recovery was 3 months, far less than the 3-year statute of limitations that apply. Moore could scarcely be said to not have been diligent in this case. The next factor that is considered is prejudice. And for that, the Weisenbacher Court looked to the case of Addison v. State of California, which also considered considered prejudice in the situation of the tolling of statute of limitations. And that standard asks first if the filing of the first claim gave the defendant sufficient notice. So if it was early enough for the defendant to be able to research the claim and prepare for the claim. Now, assuming February 8, 2008, we have a very long span for them to look at it. But if you remember the fact that the state has really been on notice of the actual facts, well, not the damages claim, but the actual facts of this, ever since the first one on January 25th, 2010, the time of the filing of the first civil claim. But they've been on notice of this since September 24th, 2008. The state as a general body has been, and specifically the Attorney General's office has been on notice since the habeas corpus complaint in November 26, 2008. The state has certainly known about this issue, known about its need to investigate, and has had repeated opportunities to investigate. Next, the Addison Standard asks if the facts of the two claims are identical, and they are. And finally, it asks if the plaintiff must, if the plaintiff has acted in good faith. And as previously outlined, Mr. Moore has acted at every point to advance his case as quickly as he could. He certainly did it wrong, but he certainly acted with good faith. He certainly did everything that he could to move it along. Again, Nevada favors deciding cases on the merits. And if we are truly to uphold the standard that the courts are open to everyone, regardless of their education, regardless of their financial capacity, then I would argue that it's absolutely necessary that pro se litigants not have the statute, or do have the statute culled when their cases are dismissed solely on procedural grounds. Finally, Mr. Moore asked that in the alternative, the court stay the running of time during this appeal, so that if you decide to roll against us, he will be able to then file an NRCP 60B1. Request with the court, which, pursuant to the standard set out in Yakim v. Davis, he would be likely to succeed on, being that he made a prompt application to remove the judgment, he showed no intent to delay the proceedings, he lacks knowledge of procedural requirements, and he has demonstrated good faith.
But that's an entirely separate case. The first case is entirely distinct. I recognize there's an overlap in what he's seeking. They're virtually identical, but those are two separate cases.
Absolutely. These are separate issues.
So we cannot reverse and remand in this case with instructions to do something under Rule 60B1 in the first case. That would be problematic.
I don't think I'm supposed to say this, but that's a very legitimate argument.
Pardon me?
I don't think I'm supposed to say this, but that's a very legitimate argument. So
your request was that we offer in this order that his pursuit initially as a pro se on this appeal should not count against him in the second case or the first case in making a 60B application for relief?
Yes.
Okay. So that's a little different twist than what you put in your briefs.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have reserved time of 3 minutes and 20 seconds, and you filed a reply brief, so you'll be allowed to stand up and rebut what your opposing counsel has to say.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have 3 minutes and 10 seconds, Justice Seda.
Thank you. And Mr. Leslie is here with us in Carson City. You're ready. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Clark Leslie. I am the Assistant Solicitor General for the Office of the Attorney General. It is my privilege to represent the appellees in this matter, the Nevada Department of Correction. Originally, there were two things that I thought would be of manifest importance to discuss with you. One is the absence of harm, and then the elephant in the room, that is the equitable tolling issue, because as my esteemed opponent admits, if there is not equitable tolling in the first case, then everything goes away. But Justice Pickering also brought up a very important point, and that was whether or not we should suspend the rules for per se litigants who happen to be inmates under circumstances similar to this. So I definitely want to address that as well. One thing that we stated in our brief but seems to have been forgotten or just passed over, is the fact that at the end of the day, Mr. Moore suffered no harm. Now, this is not a case of false imprisonment, unlike what my esteemed opponent states in his reply brief. This is not a situation where an inmate was given a sentence that was imposed, and then after factoring in good time, work time credits, there was a date certain when he should have been released from his imprisonment, and then for some reason was not. and was unjustly held beyond the date he should have been released from prison. That is not the case here. This is a situation involving parole. Now, as every member of this court knows, under NRS 213.10705, parole is not a right. It is not even a privilege. It is an act of grace. And as we have heard and as have been described in the Johnson case, which we discuss at page 34 of our brief, very succinctly, I think, and very beautifully, the court stated, if the remedy for not holding a parole hearing is to have a parole hearing. And that is exactly what happened in this case. Yes, we concede it is undeniable that he should have been given his parole hearing on February the 8th, 2005. Mistake was made. It was acknowledged in October, and he received his parole hearing on December the 8th, 2005. He was denied parole, not because of the delay, not because some change in the law or new case law came out prior to February that had he had his hearing then and then had his parole been granted because of the new change in the law, that additional time of 10 months that he didn't get his parole hearing would have been an acknowledged damage or harm. The delay had no bearing on him being denied parole. So the first and most important point that I wish to point out that has kind of been glossed over in this case is there is no harm. Now, secondly, the gorilla or the elephant in the room is the question of equitable tolling. And I would respect...
Let me pause. Excuse me for one moment. Did you make the argument in the district court that you just articulated right now?
I did not. Well, actually, it wasn't me. It was another person in my office. But this goes, I think, to the question of justiciability.
Oh, I agree. I understand that point. It was just a point of clarification for me that this was not raised in the district court.
I don't believe it was, Your Honor. In the district court, we raised the question of failure to comply with Rule 4I and the failure to comply with 16.1, 16.2, and then the statute of limitations because of that. Getting back to the question of equitable tolling, and I will sort of get back to the subject of your inquiry, Justice Pickering. Mr. Moore admits at page 7 of his reply brief, and I'll quote, Moore acknowledges that if the statute of limitations is not tolled for the pendency of the first case, the statute of limitations will have expired at some point prior to the filing of the second case. My honorable opponent has put that perfectly, and that's exactly what the burden is going to be upon Mr. Moore to establish. Now, equitable tolling or equity, I mean, what is that word? It's just another way of saying what's fair. Under the circumstances, we try to have cases decided on their merits. We prefer and we mostly rely on having substance over form. As a matter of policy, for example, in the seminal case of Copeland, they recognized that the anti-discrimination statutes very strongly had a policy of wanting the cases to be heard on the merits, and they mention in there that procedural niceties or errors will not detract from the court allowing a party to proceed and go forward. I agree with that. My client agrees with that. I've practiced 40 years of law thinking that's a true statement. But at the same time, and in conjunction with what Justice Pickering said, we have rules. Now, my honorable opponent has very eloquently stated in his brief the reasons why we should excuse Mr. Moore from making the many, many errors and the many delays that he did. And we're going to talk about those in a little bit. But it is a critical point in this area of the law that while we kindly and graciously understand that pro se litigants should be given liberality, that extends to the pleadings. It does not extend to excusing them from procedural rules. If a litigant uses the wrong language and doesn't use the magic words in a pleading. But we can all tell that what this person is saying is he thinks there was negligence, she thinks there was conversion, he or she or it thinks there has been fraud, and that person or that litigant is pro se. We will read into or we will fill in the blanks for purposes of extending and allowing the case to proceed. I don't have a problem with that. My client doesn't have a problem with that. But when we start allowing parties to avoid following very black-letter law and very specific rules, that's something different. Now, in the 8 or 9 years that Mr. Moore has had an opportunity to look at this case, there were really only two rules he had to read, NRCP 4I, NRCP 16.1, and in conjunction with that, 16.2. Now, yes, he is an inmate, but equally true, he has a great deal of time on his hands. He has shown in the case below, representing himself, that he can articulate his case very well when he wants to. He can research, he can draw upon case law, but he didn't. And in a minute, I'm going to provide you with a timeline, which I think is overwhelmingly in support of not finding that he has properly earned the right to have equity. And that's really the case here. Has someone been diligent enough to be able to say to the court, I deserve a break? I deserve the opportunity to be given a second chance. The chief case in this area, as I mentioned before, is Copeland. And Copeland did receive equitable tolling because in that particular instance, the individual had gone to the Nevada Equal Employment Commission, was not told that there was paperwork to be done, was told by the members of the staff there was nothing more they could do for them, and did not give this individual any notice that there had to be an administrative exhaustion procedure engaged in before the lawsuit could be filed. By the time that individual learned about that and filed the second suit after exhausting, the statute had run. And that's kind of what we have here. But Copeland actually serves as an exemplar for our case as to why Mr. Moore should not receive equitable tolling. First, he is not illiterate. He doesn't have cognitive difficulties. He was not in the infirmary for a long period of time. He was not in administrative or disciplinary segregation, although he could still get books. And he never alleges, and there's nothing in the record that suggests he was denied access to the prison library. He's demonstrated an ability to articulate his case, and he's had plenty of time to read those two rules, the only two that he had to know at the beginning. What I did was, there are a jumble of dates in this case, but if you look at the date from the second parole hearing of December the 8th until he filed his first complaint in 2010, 558 days passed. From that date until he got the letter from the clerk that said, Mr. Moore, you're the one that has to prosecute your case. Don't expect the state to do the heavy lifting. It's your lawsuit, your parole, your freedom. That was another 395 days. And then between that date and the date of the service of process, it was 115 days. From the date of that until the defendants were served were 19 days. And from that date until the motion to dismiss was 159 days. After the order dismissing the first action and the second action was brought, we're talking about another 381 days. And then finally, when the answer was filed and then the motion to dismiss was filed in the second case, that's another 479 days, where the case remained moribund, dead. When you add that up, that is 2,150 days. That is 5.8 years where nothing, and I mean nothing, happened in this case. So when we talk about equity and we talk about tolling, and as Justice Pickering pointed out, when we talk about whether we're going to make a rule that is going to eviscerate, in, on the one hand, the need to follow rules and make an expansion of the basic doctrine that some liberality should be given to pro se litigants. Let's keep in mind, Mr. Moore was not a Copeland. Mr. Moore was either lazy, or let me give him the benefit of the doubt, he was very indifferent to the rules of this court because he had 5 years to read two rules, and he didn't do it. Now, my esteemed opponent says, well, gee, Rule 16.1, it doesn't really say that, you know, bad things can happen and your case can be dismissed. It does say, and you know this, mandatory early case conference and mandatory rules for discovery. Mandatory, means you have to do it, and he didn't do it.
Well, how does that work in the prison setting, Mr. Leslie? Had he asked to convene the early case conference in a timely way, mechanically, how would that have gone forward with him in prison?
It happens all the time. I've handled over 1,000 inmate cases. I've had 250 cases that I've had the privilege to appear on before this court of the Ninth Circuit. We regularly get ECC statements that are filed after the attorney, either by telephone call or in person, visits with the inmate. They prepare a joint statement as to what they agree and what they may disagree with, and then they propose it to the court. Now, if the
state takes a bit more of a laboring oar than your usual defendant. Is that fair?
Yes, we end up typing up the document. We end up, once the inmate takes the initial step of contacting us and saying, let's get together our joint ECC statement, we then get the ball rolling for the meeting, and then we take his or her written statement, and we type it up, we get that inmate's approval, he or she signs it, and then we file it with the court.
Was the state, could you outline for me the issue of the prejudice suffered by the state as a result of the delay by this inmate in properly convening the 16-1 conference?
Yeah, it's not something that is going to jump out at you and being, and I'm not going to pretend that it is overwhelming in this case, but the delay in time. Mr. Henderson pointed out that, you know, the genesis of this case was on February the 9th, 2005, when it began. Then there was the correction in October. And then finally, in December of 2008, he got his second parole hearing, which was denied. Between that time and the filing of the first, and then the habeas action, and then the second action, a lot went under the water. Many things occurred. Employees came in and left. The passage of time, the potential for lost documents, the potential for evidence and witnesses to not be available, that is an inherent prejudice that occurs any time there is a delay. Now, Mr. Henderson is correct when he talks about the state of Nevada was placed on notice. And so he then makes a quantum leap and concludes, because we had notice, there couldn't be prejudice. That's simply not the case. The passage of so many years, 8 years, with virtually nothing happened, prejudiced the state. If the court has no other questions, I will submit, and thank you very much.
Mr. Lessig, I just have one question.
Yes,
it's kind of unrelated to the case, but the federal rule on this is a little different than the state rule as far as these case conferences and all that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So you've handled both of them, both federal and state. Do you have any opinion on which one's better in your view?
I do. I think the federal system is better, and please note, only because the magistrate sets up a telephone conference. And so either the dad can sit in his or her office, and then the inmate is either doing it by phone or video teleconferencing, and then the magistrate, they sort of set up a three-way phone or video system. Having the input of the magistrate talk about the joint conference statement, or in this case it would be the ECC statement, is really great because it allows the judge to point out the potential problems with both parties' cases, gives the magistrate an opportunity to get a feel for both of the plaintiff and the defendant, because later on that magistrate is going to try to get the inmate plaintiff to resolve his or her case. So the magistrate will take notes and make some mental impressions as to what might work to settle the case. So that extra step of a personal touch or interaction with the court, I think, gives it an advantage.
Thank you. I'm sorry for that digression, but it's an issue I know we all have a concern about. And
Justice Gibbons, thank you for that question.
Thank you.
You have 3 minutes and 10 seconds remaining.
Okay. Thank you. So to begin with is this issue of absence of harm. As the court has pointed out, this was not raised below, and I think that that's an essential issue because Mr. Moore never had the opportunity to explain why he felt that he had that harm. Wherein it lied, what emotional toll this placed on him, what things he felt that he had lost from it. He was never able to put forward what he felt were the merits. And pursuant to State v. Canstey, new arguments may not be raised for the first time on appeal, and I think that that is the exact reason why, is that once an issue is raised up to appeal, it's focused on that issue. The factual record is already set out, and new discovery cannot be conducted. Now, moving on to the issue of suspending the rules for pro se litigants. I think I'd start off by just saying I've been practicing law for 2 years now, and just about every time that I have to file a motion, I end up having to spend about 12-18 minutes of unbilled time just sitting there trying to refigure out how to read the rules of civil procedure. I have no doubt that by the time that you get to be a Supreme Court justice or have argued so many appeals as opposing counsel has, they come very easy. But I can tell you they're not easy or light reading, especially when you consider that Rule 16.1, you have to read all the way through and just guess which one is going to end up falling with such import, with import to you. And so certainly I'm not saying that those rules should not apply, but I am definitely saying that they should not be fatal for failing to follow them. And then also as to Mr. Moore's diligence, I think the record shows that when Mr. Moore knew he had something to do or thought he knew he had something to do, he acted. Every time a case was dismissed, he refiled some other form to pursue relief. Every time that his letter to the court that has been mentioned, he did without, I believe, if I'm not missing my factual record, but he did without the court having even given him some kind of unawareness. Mr. Moore screwed up, no doubt, but he consistently responded to every time he got a note, some kind of alert that he needed to move the case forward when a motion to dismiss was served. He filed a request for documents. Still wrong. When the actual dismissal occurred, he filed a request for a Rule 16.1 conference. He was trying. He was trying very hard. And so, in conclusion, I would argue that this court should follow the standard of Weisenbacher v. Farewell. Recognize that Mr. Moore has been diligent, and recognize that there really will not be prejudice to the defendant. Despite the passing of time, as my opponent has pointed out, the state had, from the get-go, had the opportunity to investigate these claims, interview all witnesses, build a record, and doubtless for each one of these four different attempts that are on the record, the state that will have records of those and what evidence was gathered. The state cannot legitimately argue surprise in this case or prejudice. And so in conclusion, I would argue that it really is in the interest of justice. It is in the interest of the accessibility of the courts and in making it so that everyone can have their day in court, and in the guiding principle of Nevada law that cases should be decided on the merits, that the statute of limitations be found to have been told during the pendency of the first case. And if it was told during the pendency of the first case, then regardless of when the statute of limitations begins, as long as you accept the February 8th part, Mr. Moore's case should not have been dismissed on account of the statute of limitations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case will stand submitted, but I do want to make one point on behalf of the court's program that seeks pro bono assistance on appeals. Mr. Henderson appears as a result of that program, and the assistance of our attorneys throughout the state who are willing to take on these cases is greatly appreciated by the court. And regardless of whatever the result may be in a case, the fact of the matter is that access to justice is improved every single time one attorney decides to take on a case for someone who cannot otherwise afford their services. So thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Justice Sirk, I had a comment to your well-spoken remarks. Mr. Henderson, I just add for your benefit, don't feel bad about rereading the Rules of Civil Procedure. I'm sure Mr. Leslie, together with the three Supreme Court justices, I know for a fact we do it all the time to prepare for every case, so it's hard to memorize all the particulars, you know, but we constantly have the books out, especially Justice Pickering. She has I think she travels with it, you know, like that, to check these all the time, so it's part of the practice.
Thank you all.
And I'd like to also associate myself with Justice Sada's remarks. We're deeply grateful to those who are participating in this important program, so thank you.